Hello, I'm Tyler Zawani. I'm a research fellow at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in the Department for the Anthropology of Politics and Governance. Welcome to our podcast series on political assembly, where we can convene conversations with anthropologists whose work engages questions concerning forms of political collectivity, things like crowds, publics, populations, and so on. Today, we're here with Karen Strassler, who is professor of anthropology at the City University of New York, and we're going to talk about Karen's new book, Demanding Images, Democracy, Mediation, and the Image Event in Indonesia, which was just published last year with Duke University Press. Karen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, Karen. Okay, so first question. A central premise of your book is that making, circulating, and responding to images is central to political agency within democratic polities where publicity and visibility are key. Would you say that images and publicity and visibility are uniquely important for democracies? Or does this also extend to non-democratic contexts as well? Or maybe to put this differently, what led you to frame your focus on images as a contribution to thinking about democratic politics in particular?
Okay, great. Well, I think, you know, the focus on democratic politics really came out of the specifics of what I was looking at, the moment and the place. I was doing research in post-authoritarian Indonesia, which had just emerged from 32 years of dictatorship. And you know, I was lucky to be present kind of on the cusp of that new democratic, and I put that sort of in quotes, moment. And so really what inspired me to write the book was this striking confluence between a political opening and a profound technological transformation of the media landscape, which I witnessed while I was doing actually work on my first book from 1998 to 2000. And as I write in the book, I think we really need to think about the public sphere as both an arena of actual communicative activity, where images and texts are circulating in all kinds of complicated ways, but also as a powerful figure of the democratic imagination. And that was very much true in this moment. The ideas of participation, access, free circulation, credibility, authenticity, transparency, truth, these were the keywords of democracy. And were really hitched to the idea of an open public sphere. And at the same time, the old regime, the new order, was being reframed discursively as, you know, everything being covered up, as dark, as everything being manipulated, right? Politics was just a bunch of machinations. The economy was corrupted through and through by secret deals. History was just lies and the truth was buried, right? So you had this very powerful ideological imaginary at work that framed democracy as transparency and authoritarianism as obfuscation. And so that was, you know, just a central sort of organizing feature of the ideological landscape at that moment. At the same time, pragmatically, you know, the changes that happened in the public sphere were the most tangible and visible evidence that there was a new era, you know, on the way. And so the initiation of freedoms of the press, which was one of the first things that happened after 1998, after Suharto stepped down, the elimination of the powerful information ministry and its ability to revoke publishing licenses, which had been one of the central tools for stifling dissent. These were really tangible things that happened. And then there was this proliferation of new media outlets, print publishing, book publishing, tabloids, magazines, newspapers, electronic media, you know, all just kind of boomed in this moment, as did, of course, the internet sort of coming in as this kind of new, you know, mode of communication that seemingly was beyond state control. And photographic images in particular, I argue in the book, became sort of fetishes of transparency because they really seem to embody these ideals of truth and accountability and openness and participation. And so great hopes were invested in these new technologies, in photographic images in particular, and in the public sphere in general. But at the same time, as soon as there were failures, right? As soon as images proved vulnerable to manipulation, as soon as exposure failed to halt corruption, as soon as certain violences escaped photographability, there was also enormous disappointment, right? So you know, you had that kind of euphoric highs and you know, profound lows. And over time, this euphoric techno-utopianism was also met with dystopic visions of what some people referred to as out of control democracy. So this idea that everything is sort of proliferating out of control, you know, claims are being made without any kind of guarantee or anchor. We don't know who's making these claims. Commercial interests are sort of running rampant and undermining the morality of the nation, right? So this sort of posing of this new public sphere as a threat also took place, right? So the point being that the democratic imaginary was a technological imaginary in both its sort of utopian and dystopian guises. So that has a lot to do with this focus on democracy. On the other hand, I definitely think that this is not unique to democracy, right? That the many of the dynamics and the ways that images are working that I talk about in the book and try to provide sort of an analytic language for, are true of any place where there is a complexly mediated public sphere. That is, where images are moving through a complicated network of different media platforms, some of which are privatized and commercial, some of which are not, some of which are sort of broadcast mass media, and some of which are what are something called, you know, horizontal or demotic media, right? And where there's significant opportunity for people to broker and engage with images in active ways, right? To produce them, to alter them, to comment on them, to play a role in recirculating them, in scrutinizing and commenting on them, right? These are activities that I think are characteristic of media environments everywhere. And of course, there are differences in degree of state control, in the dangers that people face, in the degree of corporate control, right? I mean, there's not that there aren't variations in this kind of landscape, but this is the nature of the public spheres that generally exist today.
Yeah, no, fantastic. That's really interesting and it makes a lot of sense. And I want to come back to some of the specificities of Indonesia, but maybe first I'll ask another more general question, which is one of the book's central concepts, I mean, the central concept is image events. And you develop this concept to focus on political processes that are set in motion by images and where images are the basis for collective and public contestation. And I wonder if you could say a bit more about how you came to settle on those two terms, image and event, and then bring them together. And I wonder in particular, what does image event give us, or what works it doing beyond some of the other conventional terms for thinking about large scale kind of political happenings, spectacle, scandal, or crisis? And then on the other, and you were alluding to this already, how might your focus on the visual here relate to other senses that play into massed collectivity in publics, like sound and touch are the most kind of obvious one. So I'd love to hear a bit more about how image event came into being.
Yeah. So I intend image event as a very broad term that can encompass something like a spectacle or a scandal. In fact, I have a whole chapter on scandals, and image events can certainly have spectacular elements to them or be spectacles. But you know, as I'm sure you know, there are certain theories of the image that kind of reduce public images to the production of spectacle. And that's just way too reductive and narrow for the variety of work that images do and the ways that people engage with images, right? The idea of the spectacle figures people as kind of passive spectators. And obviously that is not the predominant way that people are engaging with images today. So the term image event is not actually my own coinage. It came out of people writing about various kinds of public relations campaigns that were sort of staged events that were intended to be imaged. So the classic example is like a Greenpeace, you know, where they climb on some huge power tower and you know, drop a banner, right? And it's intended to be seen. That's where that term came out of. And I wanted to broaden this idea to also include these sort of more spontaneous, inadvertent, contingent ways that images can become focal points of attention and affective response and discursive engagement. So, you know, the George Floyd case, for example, is a perfect, you know, horrible but perfect example of a of an image event, right, where this amateur video takes off and it resonates with all these other images that have been circulating, and it, you know, spawns the production of memes and cartoons and street art and placards, and it, you know, participates in forming crowds, which themselves get imaged, and, you know, it just sort of ramifies, right? And I wanted a language for that kind of ramifying, amplifying, unpredictable, contingent happening that is sparked or significantly animated by images. And I think that in the kind of media environments that our public spheres, you know, are in, we can't address politics without taking this kind of image event or image work seriously. So that's one level, right? It's just sort of identifying a certain kind of process that I think is increasingly important in politics. I also wanted, you know, at a deeper level to just change a little bit the way we're talking about images in general. So, you know, we've moved in thinking about images from a focus on representation and the politics of representation to things like the materiality of the image, right? The social life of images, the agency of images, right? And the practice of image making. And this shift to materiality and practice and agency is something that has been really central in my own trajectory and is very important for me. But I found that in thinking about public images, I needed or I wanted a more dynamic language that could really account for the volatility, the mutability of images, the ways that they proliferate, right? They're not singular. They're continually sort of spawning and reforming and attaching to new things. And right. And so that dynamic process of extension in time and space was something that I felt that the dominant language that we have for talking about images, which still kind of focuses on the singular image, just wasn't getting at. And I wanted to think about images as emergent and unbounded and unfolding and unfinished, right? And so that's sort of how I came to the language of eventfulness and events. Not an event in the sense of a discrete bounded, right, happening, but something that happens over time and in space. And so that, it felt to me that this was the language that worked the best. Like any other language, it has its limits. It's, you know, it's more useful for certain things and other things. So it's not, you know, I'm not saying this is now how we have to think about images, but it is a way of thinking about images that I think is helpful, particularly for this kind of images that we're looking at in this book. In terms of other sensorial modes, touch and sound. I mean, I think there's no question that the media platforms that are most important today increasingly privilege and even, you know, demand visual content, right? And I mean, that even that's a term, visual content, you must have visual content, right? So there's a kind of tyranny of the visual that, you know, we have to contend with, and that I think, you know, is directly related to the fact that we speak about political visibility as opposed to political audibility, for example, right? I mean, so the visual does have a certain kind of priority. That said, you know, I would definitely follow W.J.T. Mitchell and other visual studies scholars who would say that, you know, all media are mixed media, right? And the visual is never alone. It's always operating alongside and against and within language, sound, touch, and so on. So, you know, to focus on the image is not to deny or to exclude other modalities. For example, in one of the chapters in the book, I'm really looking at political banners many of which are entirely textual. But I am thinking about them as images for two reasons. One is that they are given to be seen. They are placed in the landscape in certain ways so as to draw the attention of the eye, and that's crucial to how they're working. And they are being reproduced and circulating photographically. So even though they're not classically images in that they're not figural, they are textual, and their text is important, but they are also images. And so when we think about how things travel and become detached and move into new contexts, I think we're often talking about visual processes.
No, that's great. And it makes a lot of sense, actually. And maybe that leads to a methodological question, which is, how do we as anthropologists research how people engage with images? And I mean, just there are a couple moments in the book, like, for example, on page 226, you write that to be effective, these images you're talking about required a perception of authenticity. They needed to protect against charges that they were manipulated or falsified. Or in the chapter on street art, you talk about an example that was a kind of failed imitation of street art. And how do we know when something is effective, an image is effective? And how do we know when an image fails or succeeds? And how do we know or research the way that images circulating through social media or on the street are interpreted? How did you think about that? Or was that even really actually your question?
I don't know that it was my question, but it is certainly a very crucial and important question. And I think the idea of the image event is methodological as well as conceptual, because I think it is in tracking images rather than focusing on a point of production or a point of reception, but rather tracking how images move and mutate and travel into different sites and do different kinds of things in those sites based on the affordances of different media platforms that they're in, and different sort of communities that they're encountering in that way, different publics that they evoke. That's how we can start to gauge this. So my basic answer is that production is reception. As you know, I think, you know, the problem with reception studies, as sort of classic reception studies, is that they focus on a direct, temporally very cramped, dyadic encounter between a person and an image, right? And how they react in that moment of encounter. And of course, we know that when you're talking about images in particular, and you're even using the language of reading or interpreting, this is often a distortion of how people engage with images, right? Which is often in a state of distraction. Images work on us affectively in ways we don't articulate discursively and that we're not even fully conscious of. And they can have very delayed and diffuse effects. So as soon as we ask someone, what does that image mean to you, right? We've already completely distorted the process by which people live with images and live through images. So, you know, I think ethnography in general has always dealt in the more than discursive, has always had to account for that which is unsaid or unsayable. And so really we need to draw on that strength, right? And that is by attending to practice, by attending to what people do. In the book, you know, of course, I did a lot of hanging out with people in places where they're talking about images. So it's not that talk isn't important. People talk about images all the time. And of course, we need to listen to that talk. And so, you know, spending time in certain kinds of contexts, for example, the failed imitation comment. I mean, this was, you know, talking to street artists and other sort of young progressive types who were talking about the proliferation of these this particular issue as it was appearing in street signs, an issue of an extrajudicial killing that occurred that I discuss in chapter 5. And they were calling it a failed imitation. So, you know, that's and articulating why it was a failed imitation. So, of course, sometimes you do get these meta moments where people are really commenting directly in ways that are very insightful and useful. But you also have to be paying attention to what people are doing, right? To that uptake, right? if people are altering an image or forwarding an image on or liking it or destroying it or clipping it or repurposing it in some way or, you know, defacing it, right? These are all ways to gauge effects. And so when we follow the trajectories of images and the ways that they're being manipulated and transformed, that is how we can start to interpret and register reception, I think. And public images, you know, pose a particular problem because by their very nature, they are ungrounded in a particular predetermined community, right? That's the whole nature of the public. They're not, you cannot pin them down. And this is very uncomfortable for anthropologists who are trained to contextualize and ground and, you know, really locate things. And the nature of public images is that they're not fully locatable and they're slippery. And so, you know, what we need also is to understand this indeterminacy and uncertainty as a feature of what we're looking at, rather than a deficiency to overcome in our social analysis. We need social analysis that can actually account for uncertainty and indeterminacy as forces that are operating in the worlds that we're living in.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And just thinking, you mentioned trajectories. I'm actually interested in a different kind of trajectory, which is your own kind of future work. And I see the kind of clear through line from your book on photography to this work on image events more broadly. So can you say a little bit about your next kind of research project and how that came to be and whether that is that a departure? Is that growing out of stuff you've done?
Well, I'm a little bit unsure of where I'm going next, to be quite honest. I have two possible projects that I'm not sure if I'm going to be kind of working on both of them simultaneously or one is going to take precedence. It's been such a strange year to figure out, you know, what we're doing and what's possible research-wise. So one thing that I am interested in that comes out of this work very directly is really thinking about the visible as a kind of infrastructure of the political. And by that, I mean really thinking about questions of visibility, invisibility, the contours of what is seen and not seen as shaping political possibilities. And so one project that I'm developing has to do with ethnic Chinese in Indonesia and their racialization. And what I've always been interested in, right, is this relationship between actual concrete images and these sort of broader questions of visual mediation and political subjectivity and imagination. And one of the things that I am interested in looking at is how is this racialized group constructed visually? When do they come into appearance as a distinct and discrete group? And when do they disappear? And when are they marked? When are they unmarked? And what are the visual dimensions of that? And so one project, which is, would be very ambitious, would look archivally at, you know, colonial era representations of ethnic Chinese, as well as ethnic Chinese own self-presentations from the colonial era to the present, as well as ethnographically looking at ways that ethnic Chinese come into visibility, for example, in certain kinds of racialized stereotypes. But you know, there's enormous sort of mixing which really renders this sort of discreteness absurd, right? And so there are other moments in which the unknowability of who's Chinese or who's not, other registers of knowing have to do with language and you know, comportment and religion and all these other ways in which Chinese-ness is signaled that are non-visual or partly visual. So that's one project, is sort of looking at the relationship between racialization and visuality and the ethnic Chinese. Another completely different project that I have toyed with doing for a long time and I'm still not 100% sure I'm going to do, but is a project on in the US on breast cancer. And this has to do with, I'm interested in how images mediate ourselves. And so looking in a very intimate way at embodiment and images, I'm interested in general, not so much in breast cancer in particular. I'll explain why breast cancer in a moment, but I'm interested in how we know our bodies through external images and how we internalize those images. And I'm interested in what happens when there's a change in the body that one has to kind of recalibrate one's sense of oneself and what work images do in that process. And there's a, I'm not going to go into it, this would take too long, but there's a sort of Freudian concept of the body image that I find very interesting because it helps us think about both these sort of embodied experiences and these kind of broader representational regimes and how they work together. So I'm interested in that question of sort of the body is both intimate and alien. And the reason breast cancer particularly interests me is because, of course, breasts are themselves so imaged that we, even before one has a diagnosis of breast cancer, one has already encountered one's intimate, sensorially dense body as a thing in the world that is subject to all kinds of ideological freight. And so that kind of relationship is what I'm really fascinated by. So that project would also be looking at ways that people with breast cancer are producing images of their bodies and in everything from sort of, you know, cancer journey blogs to activist kind of art images. So who knows?
No, that's fantastic. I mean, both of those projects, sound both really timely and exciting and important. So, and whatever happens, I'm sure that everyone listening will be excited to read this work as it develops.
I hope so.
I'm certain. So just let me say a huge thanks, Karen, for taking the time to talk today. This was a really great conversation. And
thank you. It was wonderful. Great.